afternoon to Jimmy Bounds, who's in El Reno, and he's an old officer hand down at Malvern, Arkansas, also covered Butterfield and Magnet Cove, and Jimmy's going to talk particularly about the Bayrite mine operation on the Rock Island this afternoon, and it's all yours.
Okay, thank you, Tom. Let me explain a little bit about how that worked back in the days I was over there in 1969 up to 71. We had two switch engines at Malvern that worked what we call the hill up at Magnet Cove and Butterfield, and also Jones Mills and Malvern, and also went over east of west of Malvern. But anyway, the day switch engine at Malvern went to Butterfield.
What time did it go to work?
It went to work at 9 a.m.
Okay.
I believe it was 9 a.m. And worked around Malvern and gathered up cars for that went to the connection at Butterfield for train number either 87 or 88. And then they went on up to National Lead and either took empties or picked up loads at National Lead. Now that's one side of the mountain up at Magnet Cove. And then they brought the loads out of National Lead back down to Butterfield and either lined them up there for either train 87 or 88. Most would be train 88, because 88 went toward Little Rock and 87 went toward Hot Springs. Then the evening job went to work, I believe, at 5:30 p.m. And he would take what we call the jig hoppers.
Would you spell jig, J-I-G?
That's the way I would spell.
Okay.
He would pick the empty jig hoppers, and I think there was about 14 or 15 of them from the Dresser Magna Bar industry there in downtown Malvern. He would do his switching around Malvern again, as well as take the jig hoppers over to Butterfield, and he would leave those empties there, and then he would go to Jones Mills and switch Jones Mills with all the loads that train 87 brought in, and he would line up the cars for train 88 going back toward Little Rock, and then he would go back to Butterfield, and then he would go up on the mountain with those jig hoppers to Dresser Magna Bar on the other side of the mountain, and he would put the empties in and pick up the loads. We had two sets of jig hoppers. And he would bring those loads back down to Butterfield. And keep in mind, that is, I don't know the grade level up there. It was really a high percent grade level. And it was about a mile and a half long from the top of the mountain down to Butterfield.
What, was it a straight rail or a crooked rail?
It was more straight than it was crooked. It was both. But not too much curve in it.
Okay.
But you had to set your retainer valves up in order to have enough braking protection coming down this hill to keep them fully recharged. And those rules were covered in the timetable on page 25 of the timetable that I'm looking at of October 15, 1972. And everybody that worked those jobs took very extra precaution bringing those cars down off of the hill. Whether it had been from National Lead in the daytime, and most of those were boxcars that came out of National Lead, either boxcars or empty tank cars. They had tank cars that they had that they used up there for transporting different chemicals that they used in their products. Now, those products that they built at National Lead were oil field drilling mud products.
Mm-hmm.
And the same products were made downtown at Dresser Magna Bar. The only difference was National did all their manufacturing in one spot up on the hill. Dresser Magna Bar brought the raw ore from the top of the hill down to Malvern and then made the product from their plant downtown.
Mm-hmm.
So their expense was greater than the National Lead's was.
Hell.
But each day, it was usually a 5 days a week, we switch those two places, Monday through Friday. Now, on Saturday, we didn't go up on the hill on the weekends.
Okay.
But in making connection at Butterfield, this is where all of our traffic arrived and left, going east toward Little Rock, was with train 88. And then train 87 brought it in from Little Rock going on to Hot Springs.
Mm-hmm.
He tied up over there and left usually in the all evening late, around 6 or 7 p.m. going back to Little Rock. But also in the line of those switching operations, we had raw bauxite ore that was brought from bauxite over to Jones Mills, and it was set out over there, either there or Butterfield, and the switch engine was spotted up. Train 87 didn't do any so-called switching at Jones Mills. Our Malvern switcher did all that, and he did that at night.
Okay, was bauxite online for the Rock Island?
Yes, it was. And bauxite was, it was actually about 18 miles out of Biddle Yard, and it was between Benton and Biddle. Now, Haskell was where the two railroads split, and from Haskell going south toward El Dorado and also going on to the west toward Jones Mills and Butterfield.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, Hot Springs was 57 miles from Biddle to Hot Springs. And, of course, train 87 switched at Bauxite and also switched at Benton and did some switching at Haskell. But for the most part, Butterfield was always a big set out or a pickup. Well, it wasn't a pickup, actually, because it was not any, really not any traffic going from Butterfield to Hot Springs going on 87. It was all on 88 going back the other direction. But Jones Mill was a big switching operation back then with regard to the cable plant and the ore plant there that manufactured ingots for electric components as well as cable for electrical.
And the raw material, the bauxite to make aluminum over at Jones Mills, that came out of the mine at Bauxite?
That's correct.
Was there also, at some point, was there also some imported bauxite?
I think there probably was, Tom. I don't remember that much about the Jones Mill operation of any materials coming in on the raw stage from any other places.
Okay.
Going to Jones Mills, but there was empty reel, wooden reels, holder, well, they were reels, wooden reels.
Uh-huh.
That they wound the cable on, things like that.
Yes.
For the most part, the things that were shipped out in the final stages of the finished product were in boxcars, and with the ingots that were loaded into the boxcars, they had to have special boxcars because the flooring was too thin. The ingots were heavy and they would fall through. So we had a derailment out west of Amarillo one time, and they found out that these ingots would fall through the floors. And
oh boy!
They had to make a better inspection on that, but. That was some of the things that they encountered back in those days.
But, yeah.
Well, this was extremely heavy, good business over there back in the Rock Island days when I was there with Jones Mills and even National Lead and Dresser Magabar. Of course,
yeah.
We also had a grocery company there, Clem Wholesale at Malvern, that shipped out or shipped in, got a lot of their finished grocery products in for distribution there at Malvern, and I understand that's since closed down. But
was there a sawmill at Malvern?
No, there was a let's see, what do you call it? They use them for to put heavy products on. They're made out of wood.
Pallets. A pallet plant?
There was a pallet plant there. But there also was a lumber mill there, and it was, I believe it was, recall the name of. It seemed like it was Hot Springs County Lumber Yard, but I can't remember offhand. I knew the guys that owned it. But they, of course, would ship lumber products, mostly would be shipped out from there. But then we had also had a lumber pulpwood plant at between Sparkman and at Malvern. Timetable out to remember the names.
Sparkman down toward Camden?
Yes, sir. And that was the home of Jim Ed Brown.
Oh.
The singer.
Yeah.
I don't think it's in the timetable. Yeah, maybe it is. Yeah, it is. Manning, Oklahoma was where we loaded a lot of pulpwood. And we would
Oklahoma or Arkansas?
Manning, Arkansas.
Okay.
Would you like me to elaborate a little bit about that?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
We would, about once a week, and if necessary, we'd go twice a week, we would go make a turn from Malvern to Sparkman, and we would pick up lumber products at Sparkman, and we would also kind of return trip. We would stop at Manning and pick up the loaded pulpwood cars, bring them back to Malvern to be dispersed down to Butterfield. But usually there was about 10 or 15 of those pulpwood cars that would be loaded at Manning on each trip.
Now this this turn, was that an extra engine or used a regular switch engine?
Regular daylight switch engine, and we would program it to, when we had to go to Sparkman, we would program the work where we could make it fit with a trip going up to the mountain at Magnet Cove.
Uh-huh.
In other words, we didn't go up on a daily basis with a daylight engine up on the National Lead.
Went up there every couple of days when you needed to?
That's right, as needed.
Okay. Dresser Magabar, was that was a daily trip?
It usually was. It was a daily trip. Depending on if they got their raw ore loaded, if they needed a switch, and they would let us know. And in other words, if they didn't need a switch, we'd leave the empties in town and wait till they got loaded up above, and then alternate.
But most of the time, it was a nearly every day affair.
That's right.
Okay. Talk about the derail at the bottom of the hill.
It was a split point derail, and I understand it wasn't that way too many years ahead of me, but and I don't have the details or remember the history of why it was put in, but it was put in a few years before I got there really, in other words, you run off the cliff, you didn't run off on the railroad down there.
Something hangs in my memory, and I'm not sure it's real, and I can't, it isn't in the special instructions, but something tells me that the normal position of that derail was open, and when my job was going up the hill, obviously they had to close it to get by it. But then they had to open it behind them, because when they started back down, if somehow or another the thing got away from them, the thing was going to be open, and they go on the ground instead of running out on the main line and running into something or going to Jones Mill or Hot Springs.
I believe that's right. I believe you're right on all those remarks.
What I'm looking for is written authority, and I've begun to think that I ain't going to find written authority. So
I think what it was, Tom. I don't remember it being in the timetable, but I'm sure it was in the special instructions under the general orders.
Okay. Okay.
I don't have a copy though.
Were the general orders, were they a part of the special instructions, or were they were separate?
they were you had special instructions in the timetable, and then you had two other coverages. You had general notices and general orders. The general orders were quite a bit stronger in language than the general notices. The general notices were small details that came later, but the general orders came out once a year, and as they got amended, you'd get notice from the superintendent's office, and they were put out under the signature of the superintendent,
mm-hmm.
posted, and the crew members were required to read those on a daily basis.
I'm seeming to remember that they were posted at specified locations, it wasn't a clipboard, but it was something like that, and you, with a two-hole punch, and you hung them up there, and they're hanging on the wall, and every day when the crews went to work, they were supposed to check that thing and see if there was anything different from the day before.
That's right. It was a bulletin board.
Okay.
It was a bulletin board, and it had the general orders and the special instructions were both, and they were usually, like you said, side by side on the bulletin board. And whenever they would register in, of course, that was one of the things they did. They registered in compared their time and checked the general orders and general notices and all that.
Okay.
Now that, of course, these crews went to work at Malvern, and now you had a little bitty small office at Butterfield, and it had a telephone in it. I believe it had a dispatcher phone in it.
Probably.
Yeah, and that's where.
Was that a little building?
Yes, sir. Small, just a small building about the size of a bathroom. And,
Are you aware of whether or not there's anybody got a photograph that you know of that thing?
You know, I don't. I wish I had. But I want to mention another item of consideration that was involved in this.
Okay.
And this was the Missouri Pacific train that ran on a daily basis. It would go from Malvern over to Hot Springs and then get on the Missouri Pacific and make a trip over there. And I don't remember the location they'd go to, but they'd go over there to a pulpwood or a wood. It was a factory, and it was a large factory, and then they would come back. They'd go over there and back every day.
Mm-hmm.
And we.
So they were out there running on the Rock Island back up and back every day.
Exactly. And they would come into they would leave out pretty early going over from Malvern on over to Hot Springs, and they'd get off at Hot Springs Junction and go on the mop, and that was just this side of the yard at Hot Springs.
Okay.
And then they would get back on that and come back then in the afternoon and come back into Malvern. Of course, so you had train orders and trains that were involved with each other's directions going against each other all the time.
Yes. Everybody out there had to be aware of anybody else who was out there.
Yeah.
Well, where in Malvern did the mop get their running orders?
They got them there at the mop depot at Malvern.
Oh, so they were wired into the Rock Island dispatcher
right there
at their depot.
Yeah, they'd stop there and get their orders on the way over, and then and they'd register going and coming
at the Rock Island Depot in Malvern.
Yes, right.
Okay. That way, if anybody was curious, check on the Rock Island. They checked there, and know whether the mop was out there or not.
That's right, exactly. And they were usually the same crew every day. Well, the conductor was a preacher, the best I remember. I can't remember his name, but and I will tell a story about one time a train master and Don Hart and Bill Stiver were en route from El Dorado, and they came up to Malvern, and we were going to switch National Lead. National Lead was on strike, and our crews would go across the picket line up there,
uh-huh.
there on top of the Magnet Cove Hill. So we would One time is all we had to do this, and they required us, officers, to switch the plant. So we required the daylight switch engine to go up there with the products and not cross the picket line, but stop there and wait and let us get on the engine, and we would take the engine and cars on down into the plant area, which is probably about, 700-800 feet from the picket line down to the plant.
Uh-huh.
Of course, it was kind of on the side of a hill, too, so Bill Stiver ran the engine, and Don Hart and I pulled pins and spotted the cars, and we spotted up the empties, and we pulled the loads, and we brought the cars back down to the picket line, and then the crew had to get on the cars and the engine and bring them on down to Butterfield. So we did have some experience of switching up there on the side of the hill at National Lead.
Everybody kind of holding their breath while they're doing it.
That's right. Very cautiously.
Well, at least the three officers didn't have to go over and switch the dresser Magabar side.
No, we did not. We didn't go over there. Now, I'd been over there before. Of course, you go by it in the daylight hours. You go by the switch going by it, too. So
uh-huh.
Even though it's on one side of the hill and the other's on the other side of the hill. You got to go by the switch, but it was a very interesting operation, and I wish I'd have paid more attention to it when I was over there my short 2 years. But you just take everything for granted when you're working.
You know, I know that exactly. You know, we all look back at it that way. I wish we'd have paid attention to certain more attention to certain things. Maybe taking a few photographs here, but you know, when you're working. Those aspects really don't amount to a hill of beans.
That's right, and the Jones Mill operation was pretty complicated too, with spotting of the raw ore from bauxite, as well as placing the box cars for the loading. You had certain places, and we had good crews over there, and they did a good job. They would, they came in and. Remember the conductor on the evening job, he usually got there an hour early. He had a little drinking problem, but he'd get that over with before he got to work, and he would be sober when he got to work and in good shape. He wasn't,
uh-huh.
wasn't that bad, but he would he was very dedicated to his job, and he took very good care of it.
Kept his employer happy. It kept the mill happy, too.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah, let's see. Let me look at my notes here.
We'll tell one more story.
No, go ahead.
I remember one time we were having an inspection tour with the superintendent and the vice president of operations coming over, just ahead of
them. Are we going to name them, or shall they remain nameless?
Well, I can't name them. It was, let me think a minute. Who was our VPO at that time? Buffalo. Yeah. J.B. Buffalo, Earl Hare, and I don't remember the third party. But anyway, they came into the office there. Well, let me start over a little bit on that.
Okay.
They were due there probably about noon. Well, about 10 o'clock, the switch engine was out working there, and they had dropped a car out of Clem Wholesale Grocery Company, and it didn't clear the switch, and they dropped another car, and it sideswiped that boxcar.
Mm.
And the rivets just began to fly off the grab irons on the side. Well, I didn't want that to be seen by the inspection party coming in, so I called a mop agent over there, and I said, I don't recall his name. I said, we just sideswiped one of your empty cars here. I said, is it all right if I bring it over and leave it on the interchange? He said, oh, yeah, I don't give it. Bring it on. So I told him, I said, get that car over there and get it out of there. Don't let nobody see it. So we took it over on the mop interchange and delivered it to them. It was an empty car. And nobody ever knew about the little sideswipe. It wasn't that bad, but and I, of course, I admonished the crew a little bit. And
you just weren't looking for trouble.
That's right. But anyway, the J.B. Buffalo and Earl Hare came in, and I remember there was a new drink put out by Coca-Cola at that time. It was a Sprite.
Uh-huh.
Hadn't been in existence very long. We had some in the icebox, and Mr. Buffalo had himself a Sprite while he was there. I'm messing up your story.
No, you're not. You know, this personal touch, this business, this Magnet Cove stuff, you know, I'm going to write this stuff. It remains to be seen exactly what I put on paper. But before I turn it loose and send it to the editor, you will see it, and you and I will iron out any wrinkles and anything that you're not happy with, or we need to rearrange or delete. That's what we do. So, you know, and you're not ruining anything. I mean, and my attitude is, the more I can get you to talk about, the more I got to work with, and then when we get down to the bottom line, you and I both got to sign off on it before we turn it loose. That way, you and I both have done the best we could to create the product that some other people will be able to enjoy.
Well, that's what it's all about, and I appreciate that too, Tom. Because, you know, we may make mistakes in our memory too. So.
Well, and that's true. And you know, when I write this stuff, you know, I'm always scratching for more details. Sometimes, if you scratch a little bit, sometimes you can come up with some more. Sometimes you can scratch forever, and you're not going to get what you're looking for, simply because people can't remember it any longer if they ever knew it in the first place. And that's just that's the way it is.
That's right. Yeah.
Let me ask about these little jig hoppers. Do you remember any particular mechanical or other problems with these things?
You know, Tom, I know we talked about that before, but I don't recall those things being any trouble at all whatsoever.
Okay.
Back in those days, and I'm sure I was rather new on the officer level, but of course, I was learning as I went, but I don't recall being any problem whatsoever with those cars.
Okay. Well, and they may not have been. It's just that this old hoghead that I talked to, I don't know why, I never can remember his last name, Charles Kirkpatrick.
Charlie Kirkpatrick.
You know, was talking about, you know, when they got a cut of cars together up there on the hill to bring the loads down, you know, one of the reasons that they were always so careful is because here and there, those guys knew that there were some problems with the air system on the cars, and he attributed it to the car shaker downtown. You know, the cars, at least some of them here and there, they got a pretty good shaking, and you know, naturally, if you're going to bang a car around, sooner or later, things might come loose. So him having said that, I just thought, well, I'll ask everybody else if they're aware of such things.
Well, you know, and he's probably right to a degree there, because those cars were so old that, you know, and we were, you know, diesels hadn't been going too many years up there.
Yeah.
Locomotives and with air pressure like we had with them and using the air like we did, if you got a little leak or something, well, the crew would be the first to notice it, didn't they?
Yeah.
And, of course, they had to shake them to get the ore out of them, and that would cause a problem, too, with any kind of an air hook.
Yeah. I presume at one time or another you may have observed the car shaker in action?
You know, I did, to be honest with you.
Okay.
I really never did. I never did observe it. I wish I had him now.
Well, makes you just like all the rest of us. Do you remember, after, after cars were set in, both at the Malvern plant and up on the hill at the Dresser Magabar operations, how the cars were moved with the loads down at Malvern and the empties being loaded up on the hill. What mechanism did the company have for moving the cars in the plants?
You know, I cannot give you a good answer on that, Tom. I would say that probably, and I'm guessing on this, that they had a cable system that they had set up there with pulling them down. A lot of them had an electric motor with a cable on it.
Yes.
That they would pull them, and I kind of believe that would have been the direction they went.
Okay.
And they would pull the loads down and the empties and load them as they went up on the hill. And then, of course, and when we set them in down below, you set them in and they would unload and roll them the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And now you had a different track that the boxcars went on as far as loading the boxcars downtown.
Right.
With Dresser Magabar.
Okay, was the boxcar loading track, was that on a different side of the plant from the raw ore side?
I believe it was. I believe it was on one side of the plant and the raw ore was on the other side.
Okay.
And of course they loaded, and after they ground the raw ore up and whatever mix they used, they would it would go into paper bags.
Okay. So both of these plants, the National Lead and Dresser, the end product went out bagged in boxcars.
That's right. Now, as far as my knowledge of National Lead, they must have had some kind of a underground facility that they brought the mining products up to them from the plant up there. I don't know whether it was by cable of conveyor or belt or what.
I've been told that the National Lead was an open pit operation.
Probably was.
And earth movers, got them loaded up out in the pit and then took them up to the processing plant.
Yeah, that's probably right.
Okay. Outbound product for both of these outfits, most of it go out Rock Island toward Biddle, or any of it go to Hot Springs, or did it go? Some of it go across to the mop at Malvern?
I'd say that probably 90% or more went out to Biddle Yard.
Okay. The mop got a little bit of it at Malvern?
A little bit, but not much.
Okay. Any of this stuff go to Hot Springs? I guess that was the end of the line, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the end of the line, and you didn't have that much anything in the way of drilling an oil well over there. You could truck it to the finished product to that. So.
Okay. The bauxite ore coming over to Jones Mill from bauxite station, was that in hoppers?
Yes, it was in...
not jig hoppers, but regular...
No, regular. Let me think now, just a minute. It was in open top hoppers.
Okay.
Now, I'm going to have to be... I stand to be corrected on this, Tom. And John Henderson might know more. It was either covered hoppers or open top hoppers. But I think... Maybe it was covered hoppers. I believe it was covered hoppers. I'm going to have to change that.
Okay.
Covered hoppers.
Okay. My last question, are you aware of any photographs held by whomever, either of the Rock Island equipment and operation or either one of the mines and the plants?
Oh, golly, I don't know of any that, I'm trying to think. It's seems like at one time or another we had photographs over there around the old depot of Nash Lead as well as some of the Dresser Magular, but I don't have any idea where it would be now, Tom.
Yeah. Well, I'm not surprised. We're talking about probably close to 40 years ago or better. And I have no doubt that at least a little bit of this stuff still exists. But, you know, anybody that's got it, they probably don't remember that they've got it anyway.
Yeah, and I don't, I do have an old, I'm just looking out there at the cabinet, I've got an old, what do you call a little bitty photos that you put on the screen?
A slide?
Slide. I've got a slide program that I built back in those days after I left over there. I don't have a slide projector. Do you have one?
Yes.
Well, would you mind bringing that when you come?
Let me make myself a note.
We'll show it at that meeting.
Okay.
And we'll see what it's a training program of sorts with.
Uh-huh.
And it's probably got some track pictures in it as well as some others.
Okay. Well, who knows? While we're showing that, who knows what else we're going to see that might get my curiosity going about something else.
That's right.
Okay. Seemed like I had one more question, but maybe we answered it. Well, I can't think of anything else. I think we beat on this one pretty good. Any other thoughts on your part?
Well, not really. There was quite a bit of switching. I just might throw this in. With the switching around Malvern, we had other industries there. We had the crusher out there that shipped out rock, and we usually got that out with the daylight engine.
Where was the crusher?
It was toward the northwest part of the yard.
In Malvern?
In Malvern, yeah.
Okay. What kind of rock?
I think it was a limestone type.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, why don't we call it quits while we're winning, and I appreciate your efforts. And here and there, I'll probably have, you know, when I start banging this stuff out later this year, every time I sit down and I start writing this stuff, I come up with some more questions, and when I do, I pick up the phone and holler at a guy and say, hey, remember me? What about this and what about that? So we'll just work it that way if that's all right with you.
That's fine, Tom. You give me a call anytime. Now, we're going to be in and out, going to Fort Worth. I think my aunt's going to have surgery next week, and we may go down there. We're usually not going over just overnight. So.
No. Okay. Well, like I say, there is no urgency about this. I've got some more work to do on it. I've got some other people in Arkansas to bang on and see if they either got any pictures or if they remember anything. So it's going to be later this year when I get serious about trying to write this stuff, because I still think I can generate a little more information about it.
If you know, if I knew old Frank, the clerk there, he had a boy that was a clerk, and I don't know, I can't even think of Frank's last name now. Frank Davis, yeah. He had a boy that was, if Frank might have had some pictures of some of that over there that we don't know about.
Is his boy still around? You say his boy, what was his boy, a Rock Island clerk?
He was a Rock Island clerk, and I don't know if I ever heard his first name.
Okay.
But him and I think he would be the only one. The other boy didn't have any pictures that I know of, but and Miss B, of course, I don't think she's still alive now. She would be about 100 if she was. So, I can't think of anybody else.
Okay. Well, why don't we leave it alone, and I'll keep piddling with this thing, and I'll be in touch with you.
Okay, Tom.
And I'll with regard to the afternoon before the reunion at the end of this month, I'll be in touch with you before then anyway.
That sounds good.
Good. Thank you, Jimmy.
Thank you, Tom.
Bye now. Bye.